Excellent, she thought. A burning, bleeding ulcer the size of a tortilla. Normally, he didn't return from work until 6 o'clock, so Joey assumed that the slam of the car door had come from another driveway. When a key began jiggling the front doorknob, she tugged up her jeans, shot out of the bathroom, snatched the steak knife off the carpet, and rolled beneath the bed. Footsteps that seemed heavier than Chaz's plodded through the living room and then up the hall. Joey held her breath, thinking, "Damn, I didn't flush. If he notices, it's all over." She switched the knife to her right hand and tested her grip, the footfalls now approaching the bathroom doorway. Of all the dumb ways to get caught, Joey thought morosely, the one time I forget to flush. Life was so much simpler bossing a farm crew. You needed money, all you had to do was steal out of their pay. Most of the time they never said boo, they were so afraid you'd turn their asses over to the INS. Shipping back to Haiti, the DR, or whatever godforsaken hellhole they come from. Adios, motherfuckers. Do not pass go. The fentanyl had taken care of Tool's pain, but not the sense of displacement. He stared at the seeping tooth marks on his knuckles and thought, I hate the city. Partly it was Red's fault for not fronting him some cash. Tool had forgotten how tough it was to pry a dollar bill out of that rich little peckerwood. If Tool had been carrying even a 10-spot, why, the driver of that soda truck wouldn't be on his way to the emergency room with his face stoved in like a rotten pumpkin. Tool shook his head in exasperation. Hadn't he asked like a gentleman?
Hey, son, how about a case of that Mountain Dew?
The driver had chuckled and said he couldn't sell straight off the truck, said so in a tone that Tool took as rude and belittling. The man hitching his eyebrows and asking, How much is it worth to you, Pops? Maybe I can make an exception. Him not knowing, obviously, how desperate for refreshment a person under the influence of hospital-grade painkillers could be. Tool didn't believe in beating around the bush, so he'd let the driver know that he wasn't in a position to pay for the case of due, on account of he had no money. Promised the guy he'd catch up with him later, though, next time the mini-mart was due for a soda delivery. That got the driver laughing so hard that his head started bobbing up and down like a goddamn parrot, which Tool didn't care for one bit. Out on the farm, nobody laughed at him. Nobody dared to look even slightly happy when he came around. The truck driver was a younger fella, broad and muscle-bound and full of hisself. Most men would have thought twice about doing what Tool done, but Tool right away marked the guy as a gym pussy. It was the smile that gave him away, all those teeth so white and square, like the tiles in the John at the Greyhound Depot. The driver talking down to Tool like he was some sort of retard, Tool studying them shiny, perfect teeth and thinking, this fucker's never taken a serious punch his entire life. Then proceeding to hit the man square in the face, shattering to pieces that movie star smile and the nose it was hung on. Down went the truck driver, and off walked Tool with a whole pallet of unrefrigerated Mountain Dew, them 2-liter jumbos, which he greatly favored. Driving back to the doctor's house, he guzzled a whole bottle warm. That's how blessed thirsty he was. Now he stood belching in the hallway, trying to decide whether to take a leak, or lie down, or maybe call Red and make a pitch for some dough. The guys that bodyguard the president and movie stars and such, they get spending money. Tool was sure of it. He went in his room and kicked off his overalls and sat down bare-assed on the bed. The cell phone that Red had loaned him had the speed dial function preset to call Red's office in LaBelle. Lisbeth said that he was in a meeting, but she promised to pass along the message about Tool needing some cash ASAP. Tool wiped his bloody hand on the blanket.
I don't belong here, he thought. I'm not a city man.
He clicked on the television, and there was Oprah, that black lady what had her own show. Toole had heard on Christian radio that Oprah was richer than some of the richest white people on earth. So he decided to tune in for a while and see what all the fuss was about. Damn if Oprah wasn't yakking with three movie actresses about what a hassle it was to be famous and have photographers snooping around, following you to the grocery and the ATM, whatever. Toole didn't feel one tiny bit sorry for her and them other gals, on account of they was rich enough to build 20-foot walls around their mansions if they wanted. Butlers, bodyguards, the best of everything. Toole found himself thinking about Maureen, the old lady at Elysian Manor, alone and dying of God knows what kind of rotten cancer. Them nurses won't even let her out of the sack to take a shower or go to the can. There's somebody would trade places with them actresses in a heartbeat, Toole thought. Maureen would. She'd be smiling and waving at them photographers. She'd be so grateful not to be sick. He turned off the TV and trudged to the kitchen, where he emptied the refrigerator and started repacking it with Mountain Dew. Before long, the doctor walked in the door and asked Toole what in the name of God Almighty he was doing.
"What's it look like?" Toole said.
"But I'm expecting company." Charles Perrone pulled a bottle of white wine out of a brown bag.
"It'll fit," said Toole.
He held up his throbbing hand.
"Hey, take a look here. See if it's infected."
Charles Perrone reacted as if a tarantula had been thrust in his face. Stumbling backward, he said, "I told you, man, I'm not that kind of doctor."
"Then what the hell kind are you?"
Toole advanced upon him, snatching the bottle of wine. "I'm a biologist, not an M.D., Charles Perrone said. "I study water pollution." He grimaced when the goon presented his punctured knuckles for inspection. Toole said,
"Some guy's mouth ran into my fist. Don't it look infected?"
"There's bandages and antibiotic cream in my backpack. I'll get some for you."
"Appreciate that."
As Toole cleared a space in the freezer compartment for the wine, he wondered why a doctor of water pollution would need a bodyguard. His voice calmer now, Charles Perrone said, "See, I've got a friend coming over in a little while." Toole shrugged.
"Goody for you."
"What I meant is, maybe you could put on some clothes." Toole glanced down at himself.
"Actually, I'm pretty damn comfy as is. Maybe I'll just go to bed."
"Thank you," said the doctor. "Thank you very much." Chaz went into the bathroom, shut the door, and dug the blue pills out of his pocket. His golfing buddy had said it would take about an hour, said to go easy the first time, figure out your tolerance level. Chaz gulped two of the tablets and washed them down with tap water. In the mirror, he saw that Toole had pissed in the toilet bowl with the seat down and hadn't bothered to flush. "Pig," Chaz grumbled. He swathed one hand in tissue and vehemently pressed the lever. What was the moron doing in here anyway, Chaz wondered. He probably clogged the toilet in the guest bath with all that goddamn oily hair. After a hurried shower, Chaz phoned Rika and asked her to come over. "Have I got a surprise for you?" he said.
"I'm not in the mood."
"Oh, come on," Rika said.
"I don't feel good. I'm going to bed early."
Chaz Perrone wasn't particularly astute at reading women, but he picked up on the fact that Rika was upset. "We'll talk when you get here," he said. "I'll make it all better."
"I told you, Chaz, I'm staying home."
"Not tonight, please. Don't do this to me."
"Call me over the weekend."
"Wait, Rika. If it's about what happened at lunch..."
"Everything's back to normal, honey. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Bigger and better than ever, I promise." "You're not listening," she said curtly. "I'm whipped. I've had a shitty day, and now I'm saying goodnight."
The line went dead. Chaz Perrone cursed and slouched on the bed. It was for Rika that he'd purchased the blue pills. He had wanted to demonstrate to her, and admittedly himself, that his problem was temporary and easily surmountable. Now there was movement inside his underwear, slow but deliberate, the way an awakening snake uncoils. Anticipating the mother of all erections, Chaz despaired at the prospect of having no one with whom to share it. The clock was ticking inexorably toward readiness, but the possibilities for a partner were woefully limited. Unlike some of his friends, Chaz had no female fuck buddies to call upon in times of sudden need. The women with whom he had sex typically stopped associating with him as soon as the seedy core of his character came to light, usually within 2 or 3 months of the first assignation. Consequently, the names in Chaz's little black book fell into 2 categories. Former girlfriends who detested him, and current girlfriends who would eventually detest him. With Rika mysteriously out of commission for the night, Chaz's only backup was a dippy, new-age reflexologist who went by the name of Medea. He'd met her during a round of golf at Boca North, where she offered massages at a juice bar between the 9th green and the 10th tee. Chaz had slept with Medea only 3 times, with mixed reviews. While she was avid enough as a lover, and as lithe as a howler monkey, she owned several annoying habits, including a proclivity to hum during intercourse. Her favorite tune was called Tribal Dream, which Medea claimed had been written secretly for her by a man named Yanni. Another unendearing trait was the ritualistic lathering of her unclothed self, and by contact Chaz, with warm patchouli oil, the minty stink of which clung to the skin as obstinately as gum turpentine. No less distracting was her flamboyant taste in fashion. Chaz shuddered, recalling the night that her earrings, which could have doubled as hang gliders, first snagged and then painfully uprooted a tuft of his chest hair. Finally, there was her goofball devotion to reflexology, which she insisted on practicing upon him before every sexual encounter, brutishly wrenching his limbs and fingers, clumsily corkscrewing his neck. For days afterward, Chaz would gulp Advils like popcorn. That was Medea. She couldn't have sounded any happier to receive his phone call. When she arrived at the house, Chaz was waiting at the door with the bottle of wine and a world-class boner. Joey's memories of her family had lost detail over time, but in her mind she carried an indelible image of her parents arm in arm and smiling. That was how they appeared in most of the photographs she had saved, a close, contented couple. She remembered constant laughter in the house. Her mother, in particular, found abundant humor in everyday life. Such an outlook must have been useful for operating a casino, a factory of human folly. Now Joey imagined Hank and Lana Wheeler looking down from heaven and whimsically wondering if their only daughter had gone off the deep end. There was no denying the comedy of her predicament, hiding under the bed while her husband was trying to line up a hot date. "Have I got a surprise for you?" Chaz was saying into the phone. Apparently, the unflushed toilet had not alerted him to the presence of a hostile intruder. Joey watched his pale, blue-veined feet pace the carpet. How easy it would be to reach out with a steak knife and spear one of those plump, hairless toes. "Oh, come on," Chaz urged, in a tone well familiar to his unseen spouse. "We'll talk when you get here. I'll make it all better." Joey, studying her husband's toenails, hoping that some exotic swamp rot from the Everglades was pullulating invisibly beneath them. "Not tonight, please," Chaz, turning it on. "Don't do this to me." "Ha!" thought Joey. "She's blowing him off." "Wait, Rika. If it's about what happened at lunch, everything's back to normal, honey. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Bigger and better than ever. I promise." Now Joey had a name to attach to the presence at the other end of the line. Rika. It rang a bell. Wasn't that the name of his hairstylist? Mrs. Charles Perrone idly flexed her fingers around the wooden handle of the steak knife. "Shit," Chaz muttered. Rika evidently having hung up on him. The box spring squeaked as he sat down heavily on the bed. Sulking, Joey surmised. She eyed his bony pink ankles with their faint circumscribed tan lines. One bare heel displayed a nasty blister, the result of an ill-fitting golf shoe. The blister looked raw and quite painful, Joey thought, absently testing the point of the blade against her thumbnail. There had been an earlier opening to make a break, a 10-minute window of opportunity when Chaz was in the shower, and his male houseguest, the one with the elephant footsteps, had clomped into the guest room. For an instant, Joey had considered slipping away, crawling from beneath the bed and darting out the back door. That would have been the wise move, and she'd seriously thought about it. But then, when would she get another chance to observe her cheating, murderous husband at play? She heard a sequence of beeps on the telephone keypad, Chaz punching in a new number. "Medea?" he said. Joey thinking, "Oh, this ought to be rich." "What are you doing tonight, hon?" he asked. "Want to come over and listen to some music?" "Yeah, my place." My place. Joey felt her jaw start to grind. She observed that Chaz was unconsciously tapping his feet. The bastard, feeling cocky again. "Here's the address," he was saying. "Got a pencil?" Joey listened intently as he dressed and groomed. She knew the whole soundtrack of his routine, the brisk uncapping of his stick deodorant, the soft rotary whine of the nose hair clippers, the rhythmic plucking of floss through molars, the plangent yodel of his gargling. Realizing what lay ahead, Joey should have felt trapped, if not panicky, for she truly had no desire to hear her husband heaving and snorting on top of another woman. Yet she remained strangely calm and anticipatory. Wouldn't it be the ideal occasion on which to return her wedding band, which she'd been carrying around like a bad penny since Mick Stranahan had rescued her? The timing of such a symbolic gesture would be critical, as Joey hoped for the ultimate effect upon Chaz Perrone and his visitor, whose name, it turned out, actually was Medea. Joey heard her husband open the front door, a bit of cordial chatter in the living room, the pop of a cork. Then came the music. Celtic folk ballads, of all things. Irrefutable proof of Chaz's wanton desperation. It took him less than 15 minutes to draw Medea to the bedroom. Scented candles and sticks of incense were lit. Joey forced to swallow a sneeze. As Medea fluttered about, preparing the love chamber, Joey appraised what little she could see. A gold anklet bracelet with a turquoise charm, a rudimentary tattoo of a rose, toenails glossed lavender, feet well tanned, though not dainty. "I brought something," Medea said to Chaz, and within moments their clothes began hitting the floor in separate piles. Joey stole a peek at the tag in the peasant-style dress, size 10, and wondered if the woman was as tall as she was. When Chaz dropped his pants, Medea said, "Well, hello there. I told you we missed you." Chaz, insufferably pleased with himself. "Here," Medea, patting the bed, "let me give you a rub." "That's okay. I'm plenty relaxed enough." "Now don't argue. Mama knows best." Joey covered her mouth to keep from laughing. "But I'm already ready," Chaz said impatiently. "And you'll still be ready when we're done flexing," Medea told him. "And I'll be ready, too. Now, be a good little soldier and lie down while I warm up the oil."
"Honey, please, these sheets are 100% silk."
"Oh, hush." As Chaz stretched out, the springs of the bed emitted sparrow-like peeps. Nervously, Joey wondered how much Medea weighed. Her calves hadn't looked chubby, but that was no guarantee. And what about that large stranger in the house? Joey hadn't been able to hear what he and Chaz were discussing earlier in the kitchen, but she couldn't rule out the possibility that her husband was acting upon his long-cherished fantasy of arranging a threesome. What a pitiful irony, Joey thought, if the bed collapsed and I was crushed to death by an orgy. Wow, she heard Medea say.
Yeah,
Chaz agreed proudly.
Is that normal?
Tell me you're not complaining.
No, it's just,
Medea began, sounding hesitant.
I don't remember it being quite so
happy.
Yeah, boy.
Chaz must be in hog heaven, Joey thought. He could chat about his penis all night long. Joey cringed as Medea climbed on the bed, but there was no seismic aftermath. The conversation abated for a minute or two, then suddenly Chaz yipped in pain.
Jeez! You're killing me!
Why so tense? Medea, in the sedated tone of a yoga instructor. Tell me what's the trouble, sweetheart?
It feels like you're trying to unscrew my feet. Can't we just skip this part?
Not our limbering up exercises. No, baby. Joey regretted that her supine alignment afforded no view of the mirror on the bedroom wall. There's only one part of me that needs exercising, Chaz was saying, or else it's gonna explode.
Okay, okay. Chill out.
Communications between Chaz and Medea became less verbal, and soon the commotion above Joey attained a familiar martial rhythm. Whatever jealousy or revulsion she might have felt soon was displaced by concern for her own safety. As Chaz's exertions grew more forceful, Joey braced her palms and knees against the cross slats of the bed frame. From experience, she expected this part of the proceeding to last between 10 and 20 minutes, depending on how much wine her husband had consumed. Joey shut her eyes and tried not to visualize what was taking place an arm's length away. Her plan required clear-headed calculation. She intended to wait until Chaz was on the verge of climax before making her surprise entrance, the cue being a low, lupine growl that always preceded his seminal moment. A melody, gaseous and discordant, rose from the bed and wafted through the room. Medea was humming, with Chaz's grimly delivered grunts providing the percussion. Was it some sort of weird tantric mantra, Joey wondered? Or merely an off-key rendering of an intrinsically awful song. Suddenly she heard her husband gasp.
Christ! Why can't I feel anything?
Medea interrupted her humming.
Huh? I said I can't feel a damn thing!
Chaz panting furiously. Don't you dare stop now. Come on, sweetheart. The bed springs creaked dolorously as he pulled away. Joey couldn't imagine what might be wrong. Once her husband got going, nothing short of a thermonuclear event would prevent him from finishing.
I'm numb, he said. Aw, it's just fine. Come on,
Medea implored.
Fine for you, maybe.
Here, sweetheart, let me help.
No, don't. For heaven's sakes.
Serene Medea was beginning to sound annoyed. Joey heard a muted thump and found herself staring at Chaz's bare legs. He'd taken the radical step of vacating the bed.
What perfume is that? He demanded of Medea.
I'm not wearing any. It's the oil, or maybe the huckleberry candles.
It's not a goddamn candle. I smell perfume, Chaz declared. The exact same stuff my wife used to wear.
A glacial silence, then... Your wife?
Late wife,
Chaz amended hastily. How come you never mentioned you were married? Joey found herself rooting for Medea.
Tell her the truth, you coward.
It's a very painful memory, he said. When did she pass away, Chaz? A different sort of silence followed, as uncomfortable as the first. Joey longed to see his expression. He said,
I'd rather not get into it. Too depressing.
Obviously not that depressing, Medea remarked caustically. I see you're still ready for action.
Yeah, well, he's got a mind of his own.
Medea sounded unamused.
Like I said, I don't wear perfume.
Whatever you're smelling is in your imagination.
It's Chanel, Joey almost whispered.
Before leaving the island, she had innocently dabbed a fleck behind each ear. It was significant that Chaz had sniffed out her scent amid the putridly sweet fumes from Medea's traveling head shop. "Look, I gotta go," Medea said abruptly. "No, let's try again. I'm not liking the vibes here, Chaz." "Wait a sec! Now hold on! Please?" The despair in Chaz's tone was genuine. Hearing him get shut out was almost as good as a wedding ring ambush, which Joey decided to postpone out of sympathy for Medea, who was now out of bed, briskly gathering up her candles and oils. "You can't go! You can't!" Chaz was saying. "Just look at me!" "Very impressive. You should get it bronzed."
"You want to take a bath? We could try it in the bath."
He blocked her into a corner, his toes nearly touching hers. "Chaz, I said no."
"Hey, come on! Don't be like this!"
Joey heard a guttural exclamation that elongated into a slow, pleasureless moan.
"Stop!"
Chaz blurted finally. "You sure don't listen very good," Medea said.
"You're really hurting me."
"In reflexology school, they give us special exercises to make our hands strong. Can you tell?"
"Oh, my God," said Chaz.
"I bet I could snap it like a breadstick."
"I'm sorry I didn't tell you about my wife. I'm sorry for everything."
"Now don't get all mushy on me," Medea said.
"You gotta stop. Those fingernails.
They've gotten long, haven't they?"
"I'm begging you. I'm begging," Chaz said.
Joey was enjoying herself. She liked the girl's style. "I'll let go now," Medea was saying. "But if you so much as wiggle that thing in my direction before I get out the door, I'll damage you so badly that you'll never have a sexual experience again. Not even with yourself. Understand?"
"Yes."
"Ouch!"
"Yes."
They dressed wordlessly. Joey could envision the dazed, whip-puppy look in her husband's eyes. She had seen it herself, that time she decked him for calling her a crude name. "Well, goodbye," Medea said, poised at the doorway. Joey noticed that she was wearing hemp flip-flops.
"Sorry about tonight. Honestly," Chaz said.
"Can I call you again?"
"Are you fucking serious?"
It was then that the floor quaked beneath Joey, as if a refrigerator had been dropped from the roof. A wail of inhuman duration swelled up from elsewhere in the house.
"Oh, Christ," Chaz said weakly. "What now?"
Medea was already running by the time Chaz found whatever he was fumbling for in the drawer of the nightstand. Joey Perrone waited to hear him jog down the hall before she scooted from beneath the bed and peeked around the corner. The steak knife felt flimsy and ridiculous in her hand, but she didn't dare put it down. The shades were drawn on all but one of the bedroom windows. Mick Stranahan looked inside the house and was discouraged by what he saw. A prodigiously heavy-set man, stark naked and swilling from a jumbo bottle of Mountain Dew. Initially, Stranahan thought the man was wearing a tatty sweater, but on closer scrutiny it appeared to be an astounding cultivation of upper body hair. The man sat alone, watching country music videos on television. No sign of Charles Perrone, the frizzy-haired woman, or Joey. Stranahan ducked below the window and pondered his bleak options. A confrontation with the mountainous stranger seemed unavoidable if Stranahan intended to search the house. Joey had left the spare key inserted in the back door, so Stranahan simply turned the knob and walked in. Cautiously he moved through the empty kitchen, heading toward the darkened hallway. He paused to listen by the guest room, then stepped inside. The ape man squinted up at him in bafflement, runnels of lime-green soda streaming down his jowl. Stranahan turned off the television. "I need to look around the house," he whispered. "Are you going to give me any trouble?"
"What a dumbass question. You bet I am."
Muffled pounding and a creepy, disharmonious mule came from the direction of Chaz's bedroom. "Are you a friend of Mr. Perrone?" Stranahan asked the hairy stranger.
"I'm his bodyguard," and I've been waiting days for this.
The man got up and trailed Stranahan out of the room.
Where do you think you're going?
He demanded.
What the hell are you looking for?
Stranahan turned and said, Friend of mine, a lady friend. The man scratched thoughtfully at his crotch. Go ahead and knock me on my ass, Stranahan told him. I'll probably holler like a baby, but at least it'll spook everybody out where I can see who's who. The man said,
You nuts or what?
It's not much of a plan, Stranahan conceded, but it was the best I could do on short notice. The goon seized him by the collar and began moving toward the back door. Stranahan used the man's own momentum to steer him into a corner, then drove an elbow into his Adam's apple. The man didn't pitch over right away, so Stranahan followed with a right hook to the base of the neck, throwing all his weight into the punch. The man toppled, swiping blindly as he fell. The house shuddered to its beams. Stranahan ducked outside, circled to the front, and crouched behind the Hummer in the driveway. Inside, the bodyguard erupted with a hellish howl as he regained respiratory function. The frizzy-haired woman was the first to bolt, her flip-flops spanking on the walkway as she galloped for her car. Stranahan waited 2 full minutes after she was gone. When no one else emerged, he retraced his path to the kitchen window. There he saw Chaz Perrone standing naked in a posture of helplessness over the prone, flopping figure of the ape-man. In profile, a pistol was visible in Chaz's right hand. Beneath that, a jutting manifestation of sexual readiness. Stranahan heard the nearby slam of a heavy door, and moments later an automotive ignition. His pulse was pounding as he hurdled a hedge of Ixoras and ran toward the road. The Suburban was moving away slowly, lights off. Stranahan waved his arms as he ran after it, thinking, Surely she'll be checking the rear view. After what just happened, any sane person would worry about being chased. Finally, at the far end of the block, the brake lights flashed and the passenger door swung open. Mick Stranahan jumped inside and motioned for Joey to hit the accelerator. 10 miles later, when he finished lecturing her about taking crazy chances, she said, Nice haircut, sport. Hey, at least I don't smell like a dumpster at Woodstock. Joey smiled mischievously. That's not what Chaz thought. 16. Tool was in a more talkative mood since they'd detoured to a convalescent center, so he could pop in on somebody named Maureen. Obviously, she was his hot new drug connection, probably a rogue nurse, Chaz Perrone had surmised, while watching Tool configure an array of fresh fentanyl patches on his shaven shoulders.
Tell me about your wife,
Tool said on the long drive west. Chaz was caught off guard. What about her?
What was she like before she died?
Tool asked. Beautiful? Blonde? Smart? Funny? It was a part of Chaz's widower script that required no rehearsal, because it was the truth. Nonetheless, he found it disquieting to speak the words aloud, as if they reminded some weak and sentimental part of him what he'd lost. Disdainfully, he appraised the stubborn, useless bulge in his trousers.
So how come you ain't all sad and blue?
Tool asked. Who says I'm not? Tool gave a salacious laugh.
It's only been, what, a week? And already you're on pussy patrol.
If you're talking about that woman who came over last night, Chaz said, she was a professional masseuse.
Yeah, and I'm a fucking astronaut. Come on, Doc. What happened between you and your old lady?
None of your damn business.
Oh, relax, Tool said.
Chaz was annoyed by Tool's prying, though he realized that interpersonal sensitivity was not a signature trait among crew bosses on vegetable farms. In fact, the question posed by Tool could just as easily have come from any of Chaz's golfing buddies. And the answer, although it could never be uttered, was simple. Joey knew too much. Or if she didn't know, she certainly suspected. What other choice did Chaz have but to kill her? If the Everglades scam was exposed, the media would have crucified him. A bribe-taking biologist would be front-page news even in a sewer of corruption like South Florida. Chaz surely would have been sent to prison or whacked by Red Hammernut, or possibly both. He found it ironic that, if the truth ever came out, Tool, more than anybody, would appreciate the cojones that it took to throw Joey off the cruise liner. As they approached the pump station, Chaz stopped on the shoulder of the levee and kept the engine running. The marsh shimmered under azure skies that stretched as far as the horizon, but Chaz would have been infinitely more relaxed in the parking garage of a shopping mall. He dreaded having to forsake the steel embrace of his Humvee for the loathsome, predator-infested wilderness. Tool said,
"Nice and peaceful out here."
"Yeah, paradise."
"What? You'd rather be sitting bumper to bumper on I-95? Are you sick in the head?"
Chaz leaned on the horn to frighten off lurking panthers. Ignoring Tool's puzzled scowl, he said, "Okay, let's get it over with." Then he climbed down from the Hummer and began changing into his wading gear. Tool examined the new red seal on the left front tire and pronounced it airtight. That was how Chaz's morning had begun, with a flat. The steak knife protruding from the tread had come from the set in his own kitchen, and Chaz assumed that the culprit was the same man who'd broken into the house and tangled with Tool.
"Hey, look at the gator!"
Tool pointed to a four-footer, nosing curiously out of the sawgrass. "Adorable," Chaz said.
"He's a chunky little sumbitch, huh?"
"Sure is," Chaz thinking. "It's like I died and woke up on the fucking Discovery Channel." He was unsheathing the two-iron when he heard gunfire, prompting him to dive beneath the Humvee. Peeking out, he saw Tool sloshing out of the sawgrass and up the embankment, dragging the limp alligator by its tail. The butt of Chaz's Pawn Shop 38 was visible in a front pocket of the goon's overalls. Perfect, Chaz thought bleakly. He could see the headline, "Everglades Biologist Busted for Poaching."
"Ever tried one of these?"
Tool was grinning as he presented the dead animal for inspection.
"The way to do it, you batter the chunks and fry them in peanut oil."
Not so long ago, the egregious stupidity of plugging a gator would have propelled Chaz into a tirade. Now he wearily accepted such incidents as further proof that life was unraveling beyond his control. In an act of laughable futility, he tried to explain to Tool that shooting a federally protected species was a crime punishable by heavy fines and prison time. Tool chuckled and told him not to worry. The evidence would be gone after supper. As Tool loaded the oozing corpse into the back of the Humvee, Chaz stepped aside without objection. He was well beyond his default thresholds of shock, disgust, or even anger. He picked up the two-iron, clipped a sample collection container to his waders, and trudged into the brown water.
"Need a hand?"
Tool calling from the shore.
"No, sir," Chaz said.
His confidence in Tool's bodyguarding skills had been eroded by the man's lackluster performance against last night's intruder, who, by Tool's own bitter account, was 80 pounds lighter and 20 years older than Tool himself. That the prowler had fled unscathed from Chaz's home was less discouraging than the fact that Red's hired goon had been left blubbering and puking on the floor. Tool had spent the rest of the night in loud recuperation, an ice-filled towel wrapped around his throat. His description of the attacker matched no one known to Chaz Perrone, who figured it was a seasoned thug recruited by Detective Rolvog as part of the blackmail enterprise. When Tool announced his intention to dismember the intruder the next time their paths crossed, Chaz had to restrain himself from sarcasm.
"You want the gun?"
Tool yelled from the embankment.
"I'm fine," Chaz snapped irritably.
With the golf club, he hacked a path through the cattails, which had grown dense since he'd last visited this particular sampling site. The lush bloom was a bad sign, indicating a copious and harmful influx of agricultural-based phosphorus. The result was what legitimate biologists would call a loss of characteristic calcareous pyrifiton mat. In plain English, it meant that Red Hammernut's farms were flushing so much fertilizer into the water that it was choking part of the Everglades to death. If any of Dr. Charles Perrone's colleagues were to drive up unexpectedly and observe the proliferation of cattails, they would know instantly that Chaz had been faking the phosphorus readings. That was why he ordinarily uprooted the incriminating fuzz-tipped stalks, but today there were so many, and he was far too preoccupied to spend hours slashing in the muck. Chaz groped at his crotch through the thick rubber leggings and thought, "If I died now, they'd never get the coffin shut." 16 hours after swallowing the blue pills, he still carried a baton in his pants. There was absolutely no sensation other than bulk, a numb and obstinate stiffness that even the creeping chill of the pond could not deflate. For Chaz, it was the cruelest of afflictions, an enduring yet pleasureless woody. Hurriedly, he dipped up the sample and flailed back toward the levee. Droopy-eyed from the drugs, Toole commented that it was the silliest goddamn job he ever heard of, filling bottles with swamp water. "Does it pay good?" he asked. "I want a gig like this." "Help me out of these waders," Chaz said. The gnats and flies that were tormenting him displayed no appetite for Toole, whose moist carpet of body hair served as a natural pest deterrent. "Hurry up," Chaz said, Toole tugging listlessly at the heavy leggings. Considering his streak of bad luck, Chaz elected not to dump out the water sample at the site, as he sometimes did to avert the risk of leakage on the Hummer's sweet-smelling upholstery. It turned out to be a prescient decision. The capped Algine brand container was positioned fortuitously on the front seat when they unexpectedly encountered Marta, Chaz's boss. She was driving her State of Florida pickup truck down the dike in the opposite direction toward the spillway from which Chaz and Toole had departed. Chaz's rampaging paranoia was such that he refused to consider the possibility that Marta's appearance was part of a routine patrol. "You're already done out here?" she asked. Chaz nodded and held up the bottle of water. "Want me to take that? I'm heading back to the office anyway," Marta offered. "Oh, no, that's all right." Chaz gripped the container with both hands in case Marta tried to reach in and snatch it. If she or any other scientist of the water district tested the sample for phosphorus, Chaz would be finished. So would Red Hammernut. Predictably, Marta was taken aback by the sight of Toole in the passenger seat. "Grad student," Chaz blurted. "He asked to ride along for a day. I didn't see the harm." Toole might as well have been wearing a strapless evening gown the way Marta was staring. "Where do you go to school?" she asked. Toole turned inquiringly to Chaz, who said, "Florida Atlantic."
"Yeah," Toole grunted. "Flor-dilantic."
Marta smiled gamely. "Well, that's a good program. Well, you're supposed to sign a liability waiver if you're out in the field with district staff, in case of an accident or something." "My fault. I forgot," Chaz volunteered, thinking, "Thank God I covered the dead gator with my waders." Marta turned her truck around and waved goodbye. As they followed her down the levee toward the highway, Toole said to Chaz,
"Look at you. Your hands are shaking."
"Have you got any idea what would have happened if she'd seen—" Chaz was jerking his chin toward the back seat. "That?"
"Oh, I had a story all ready to go."
"I'm sure," Chaz said.
"Could say we found the poor thing shot on the dike, and we was running it to the vet doctor."
Brilliant, Chaz thought. An alligator ambulance service.
"My stomach's killing me," he muttered. "Plus, there's a leech on your face."
"That's not funny."
"Just a little un."
Toole pinched it off and flicked it out the window.
"Damn, boy, you's white as a sheet. Maybe you ought to find another job. Seriously."
If only it were so simple, Chaz thought. He touched the tender spot on his cheek and wondered disconsolately if leech slime was toxic. The cell phone rang, but he made no move to grab it. Tool checked the caller ID and announced it was a blocked number. When Chaz picked up, the blackmailer said,
"You're right. We should do a meeting."
Again with the Chuck Heston voice, though it was easier on the nerves than the Jerry Lewis.
"Anytime," Chaz said. "Tell me where and when." "Midnight. The boat docks down at Flamingo."
"I forget where that is."
"Invest in a map," the blackmailer said curtly. "And don't bother to bring the caveman."
Chaz said, "So it was you last night at the house."
"Yep. How was your hot date?"
"Very funny."
"Still, I was impressed by how quickly you've gotten past your grief."
"See you at midnight," Chaz Perone said. Joey stood alone in front of the bathroom mirror and said, "Girl, now you've gone and done it." She had tried to be good, tried to stay the course. She'd even started a list. 1, he's too old for me. 2, I'm too young for him. 3, he's got a rotten track record. 4, I've got a rotten track record. 5, he's never heard of Alicia Keys. 6, I've never heard of Carla Bonoff. 7, he lives on an island and shoots at strangers who mess with his dog. 8, I live... That was as far as she'd gotten with her 10 sensible reasons not to sleep with Mick Stranahan. Surely there were more than 7, but instead of knuckling down to remember them all, Joey had gone ahead and slept with him. "You've lost your marbles," she told herself in the mirror. To make matters worse, it had been her idea. 3 in the morning, she's lying alone in bed with the windows open and the taste of the ocean breeze on her tongue. Every time she shuts her eyes, she hears this weird, steady, chirping noise. Screak, screak, screak. And every time she opens her eyes, it stops. So the noise is strictly in her mind, driving her batty, when all of a sudden she figures out what it is. Bed spring. The chirping noise inside her skull was the sound made by the mattress springs while Chaz was trying to hump his hippie date and Joey was under the bed. Recalling that surreal scene, cowering like a trespasser in what was once her own bedroom, eavesdropping on the lustful exclamations of a man who was, until only a week ago, her own husband and partner, Joey had felt degraded and lonely and pathetic. She'd gotten up and quietly made her way to the living room, where Mick Stranahan was asleep on the couch. Gently she had squeezed beside him, telling herself at the time that all she wanted was a sympathy snuggle, somebody strong to hold her for a little while. But once she had pressed herself against him and fell into the easy rhythm of his breathing, she'd realized that sweet platonic hugging wasn't going to cut it. She needed more. "I'm so lame," she said, and splashed her face with cold water. When she went outside, he was sitting on the seawall, talking on the cell phone. After he hung up, he asked her to sit down. "You look about 18 years old this morning," he said. "Nice try, Mick."
"It's true."
He whistled for Strom, who was nose to nose with a grumpy pelican. "We should talk about last night," Joey said.
"I was dog-tired. I did my best."
"That's not what I meant. You were wonderful," she said. "But I think we ought to clarify a few things." He patted her hand. "That's the last thing on earth we ought to do. Trust me." Joey pulled away. "Don't make fun. I'm being serious."
"Me too," he said.
"I've had more of these morning-after chats than you have, and not one has ever resulted in clarity, inner peace, or mutual understanding. Let's go eat some breakfast." "But I'm afraid it was a grudge fuck," Joey said. "That's what Rose would call it."
"Ah, more worldly wisdom from the book group."
"Well, What if I jumped your bones just because I was furious at Chaz?
Then I owe him one, Stranahan said. Bless his lying, murdering, cheating, burnt cinder of a soul. Aren't you getting hungry?
No.
He pulled her close and held her there, Strom nuzzling the back of her neck. Last night you were gloating, remember? Telling me how Chaz got stuck in neutral, Stranahan said. How his cannon had jammed, all because he smelled your perfume. You said it was priceless. That was your word. Priceless, knowing he was crippled by the thought of you. Joey had to smile. It was a moment. I heard him tell her that he couldn't feel a thing. He was numb from the waist down. Well, there you go, Stranahan said. That's 100 times better than a routine grudge fuck. Even Saucy Rose would agree. Now, if I don't get some black coffee in my veins...
Mick, hold on.
Hush. He held a finger to her lips. Honestly, I don't want an explanation of what happened last night. Allow me the middle-aged illusion that you were overcome by my stoic, virile charms. Joey slumped playfully against his shoulder. Okay, cowboy. I give up. That's my girl.
Was that Chaz you were calling?
It was, Stranahan said. We're on for midnight. And what are we demanding, blackmail-wise?
Good question. I was hoping for one of your famous lists, he said.
Meanwhile, I expect Detective Rolvag to visit our young widower soon. There's been a surprising development in the investigation of your disappearance.
Do tell.
Shocking is the word for it, Stranahan said. Simply shocking. Carl Rolvag turned the place upside down. 2 entire pythons, 14.5 linear feet of muscle, yet somehow they disappeared like fleas inside his puny apartment. Incredible, Rolvag thought. Where could they be? The previous night he'd forgotten to latch the lid of the tank after refilling the water bowl. It had happened twice in the past, but his sluggish pets never noticed. Now it was springtime when snakes become active, and the prowling pythons had taken advantage of his carelessness. Rolvag searched beneath the furniture, above the bookcases, behind and inside the major appliances. Nothing. When he got to the bedroom, he experienced a ripple of apprehension, for he saw that he'd left a window open. Had the snakes escaped outdoors? The detective gazed 7 stories down at the grid of shuffleboard courts that was the social and geographic hub of the Sawgrass Grove condominium. Along a line of bedraggled hibiscus bushes, Nellie Schulman was walking her precious petunia, a foul-tempered cur that appeared to be a cross between a chinchilla and a wolverine. Several of Mrs. Schulman's neighbors were occupied by the same ritual, attached by dancing leashes to manic balls of fluff. From his vantage, Rolvag counted 5 dogs, all of them edibly sized for a python. The detective understood the urgency of finding his missing pets before they got hungry again. First, though, he had to nail Charles Perrone. On the way to work, he called his source at the phone company, who without much grousing agreed to help. Time was running out, and Rolvag needed to catch Perrone in a lie that couldn't be discounted as a misread wristwatch or some other innocent mistake. Rolvag's man at the phone company promptly called back with numbers and names, only one of which was important to the detective. Rika Spillman opened the door as soon as he flashed his badge. She looked as if she'd spent the night in the trunk of a car.
"Are you all right?" Rolvag asked. Soon as I make some coffee.
Rolvag noticed at least 6 empty beer bottles in the trash and no sign of company. He said, I'm investigating a missing person case. I believe you know her. Joey Perrone. Rika appeared to wobble. Rolvag helped her navigate toward an armchair.
I wasn't even there, she said.
Where?
On that cruise.
I know you weren't, said Rolvag, perplexed.
Why are you here?
She laughed abjectly. Somebody put my face on a milk carton or what? Suddenly I'm Miss Popularity.
The detective said that he'd watched Charles Perrone make a call from a payphone in a Fort Lauderdale hotel. It was Saturday evening, the day after Mrs. Perrone disappeared. The number that Mr. Perrone called was yours. When I asked him who he was talking to, he gave me the name Rika. She sagged.
What else did he say?
No. Wait. I want to call a lawyer. Rolvag pulled up another chair. You don't need a lawyer, Miss Spillman. I just want to ask a few questions about Mr. Perrone's relationship with his wife. Your personal impressions and observations.
Observations?
You know. Did they seem happy? Did they argue a lot? Rika eyed him sullenly.
Mr. Perrone and I didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about Mrs. Perrone.
But did you notice anything, any unusual signs of tension when the two of them were together?
I was never with the two of them together, Rika said sharply. I was only with Chaz.
Joey wasn't ever home when you were there?
Rika seemed genuinely insulted.
I don't know what Chaz told you, but I'm not into threesomes, okay? Not my scene.
The detective frowned. I'm very sorry. I believe Mr. Perrone might have misrepresented the nature of your association.
You're damn right he did.
He said you were their cleaning lady.
Come again?
Rika sat forward. That night in the hotel lobby, he told me he was calling to give you the alarm code so you could get in to do the house.
The cleaning lady.
Rika's voice was like wet gravel. Rolvag flipped through the back pages of his notebook. Here it is. Mr. Perrone said you were the cleaning lady and I could check it out myself. He said your first name was Rika, but he couldn't remember your last name. Rika swallowed hard, working her jaw. So I got it off the toll records from the phone company, the detective said. Rika rose, rubbing her eyes with a wrinkled pajama sleeve.
Listen, I gotta get ready for work.
Is there anything else you can tell me? Rolvag asked.
Yeah. I don't do houses, I do hair, she said. And Chaz's burglar alarm was broke, so the code didn't matter anyway. You can check it out.
Not exactly a smoking gun, Rolvag thought, but it's better than nothing. Back at the office, he rushed to tell Captain Gallo everything that Rika Spillman had said. Gallo shrugged. So, Perrone lied. Again, Rolvag said. So? He had a secret squeeze. Doesn't make him a killer, the captain said. Of course he lied about the phone call. What'd you expect him to say? Yes, officer, I was just chatting with my girlfriend. She was all broken up to hear about my wife falling overboard and drowning on our anniversary cruise. Come on, Carl. Sometimes a lie isn't a clue to anything. It's just a reflex. On that subject, Rolvag could not dispute Gallo's insight. The detective pleaded for a few more days to lean on Rika. She's highly pissed off at Perrone. She might give us something useful. Gallo shook his head. If she's not wearing a diamond engagement ring from your prime suspect, I ain't interested. We need a motive, Carl. Something more reliable than the word of a sulking bimbo. Unless she was in on it, too. Not likely, Rolvag said. A courier appeared with a plain cardboard envelope zippered in plastic. Gallo automatically reached for it, but the courier said it was addressed to Rolvag. Surprised, the detective opened the envelope and removed a legal-sized document. Gallo cracked.
What's that? Paternity suit?
Rolvag was so engrossed in the contents that he wasn't listening.
What? Gallo pressed. And don't tell me it's another job offer.
The detective continued reading, turning the pages. I'll be damned, he murmured to himself. Gallo exhaled impatiently.
Carl, don't make me pull rank. What the hell is it?
Rolvag glanced up with bemusement. The last will and testament of Joey Perrone, he said.
leaving $13 million to her loving, devoted husband. 17. A tow truck dragging a rust-pock Cordoba nearly clipped Carl Rolvag's unmarked sedan as he turned into West Boca Dunes Phase 2. The detective noticed the battered old car on the hook, figuring that kids from across the tracks must have stolen the thing and ditched it in Charles Perrone's neighborhood. Nobody who lived there would be caught dead driving a heap like that. Rolvag parked next to Perrone's yellow Humvee, its leering chrome grille speckled with bug splats. Parked crookedly in the swale was a second car, a spotless new Grand Marquis. The barcode sticker on a side window pegged it as a rental. Rolvag touched the hood, which was cold. He heard someone hammering behind the house and walked around to the backyard where a man he recognized as Earl Edward O'Toole was pounding a white wooden cross into the lawn. The detective set down his briefcase and identified himself. He said, "Were you a friend of Mrs. Perrone's?" Earl Edward O'Toole seemed thrown by the question. He shook his head negatively and went on hammering. "Is the cross for her?" Rolvag asked. Earl Edward O'Toole mumbled something indecipherable. Rolvag stepped closer in order to read the hand-lettered inscription on the cross. Randolph Claude Gunther, born 2-24-57, returned to the forgiving arms of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ on 8-17-02. Please don't drink and drive. Friend of yours? Rolvag asked.
My dog, said Earl Edward O'Toole, avoiding eye contact.
That's quite a name for a dog, Randolph Claude Gunther.
We called him Rex, for short.
I never heard of one living 45 years, the detective remarked. Parrots can, tortoises too, but I'm not so sure about dogs. Earl Edward O'Toole took another hard swing with the hammer.
Well, he come from good stock.
What's that on your back? Rolvag said. Those stickers. Earl Edward O'Toole hesitated.
Medicine,
he replied guardedly.
For what? I get seasick.
The detective counted 5 patches and whistled. Earl Edward O'Toole said,
I'm taking a sea cruise.
Yeah? Whereabouts? Again, Earl Edward O'Toole paused.
Haiti,
he said after a moment.
Me and my mom.
That's a fine idea. Take your mind off poor old Randolph. Rolvag was enjoying himself. Interludes with such entertaining freaks would be rare once he got back to Minnesota. Can I ask why you're planting the cross here? I don't see a grave.
'Cause he died in a plane crash,
Earl Edward O'Toole said,
and there wasn't nothing left to bury.
But it says don't drink and drive.
On account of the pilot was trashed at the time.
Ah, and these other crosses? The detective pointed toward 3 more, stacked flat on the grass. Who were they for, Earl?
Rex's puppies. They was all on the same plane,
Earl Edward O'Toole answered peevishly.
How the hell you know my name, anyway?
Nice chatting with you. Rolvag picked up his briefcase and headed toward the house, where Charles Regis Perrone was waiting cheerlessly at the back door. The white crosses had been erected along Glades Road, west of the turnpike, 4 of them in a cluster, memorializing a terrible head-on. With numb resignation, Chaz had watched Red Hammernut's goon uprooting the crosses until a car screeched to a halt on the shoulder of the highway. 2 young men, identifying themselves as brothers of the late Randolph Claude Gunther, had leapt out of the car and angrily confronted Toole about stealing the markers. The men had brought fresh-cut sunflowers to hang on their brother's cross, and a volume of Bible verses from which to read. With Toole ignoring their remonstrations, the men had begun preaching loudly at him, invoking Satan and other biblical scoundrels. Toole had responded by heaving the 2 brothers into a roadside canal,
shredding their book of verses and eating the flowers. Chaz had looked on with the shivers. Tool had returned to the Hummer, carrying the four crosses on his shoulders, saying brightly,
"I got a whole field of these suckers at home."
Chaz had managed.
"They look real nice in the ground. Plus you don't gotta prune 'em like you do trees and shrubs."
"Excellent point," Chaz had said, making a mental note to call Red Hammernut first thing in the morning to plead for a new bodyguard. After they'd returned to Chaz's house, Tool had borrowed a hammer and announced that he was planting the traffic crosses temporarily in the backyard. Chaz would have objected more strenuously if he'd known that Carl Rolvag would be dropping by. "How do you know Mr. O'Toole?" the detective asked at the door. It was the first time Chaz had heard the thug's actual name. "He's just a friend of a friend." "The friend being Samuel Johnson Hammernut?" Rolvag said. "Yes. Well, actually, he was an acquaintance of my wife's. I barely know the guy." "Mr. O'Toole or Mr. Hammernut?"
"Neither of them," Chaz said innocently.
The detective rubbed his chin.
"That's sort of strange."
"What do you mean? Strange how?" asked Chaz, on the verge of a blow-up. The cop was toying with him, like a cat batting around a ball of yarn.
"Your Humvee, one of Mr. Hammernut's companies, purchased it for you," Rolvag said, "according to the records of the dealership."
"Oh, shit," Chaz thought.
"You hardly know the man, and he's buying you a $60,000 sport utility vehicle?"
Rolvag, now actually scratching his head, just like that flaky Columbo character on television. Chaz was seething on the inside, but he managed to look calm.
"Let me explain," he said to the detective. "The Hummer was a birthday present from Joey. Red knew Mr. Hammernut. He knew the salesman personally, so he got a really sweet deal. Joey paid him back later."
"With a check or a wire transfer?"
"Actually, it doesn't matter. Either way, the bank should have a record."
Chaz Perrone shrugged.
"I don't know how she handled it. It was her money."
Now they were sitting in the kitchen, Chaz with an untouched beer, the cop with his usual Sprite. During lulls in the conversation, sizzles and pops could be heard from a frying pan on the stove. Chaz leaned forward and lowered his voice.
"Can we please cut all this ridiculous bullshit? Just tell me how much you want."
Rolvag seemed genuinely baffled.
"Oh, come on," Chaz said. "Save me that god-awful trip to Flamingo."
"You're losing me." Not wishing to spook the crooked detective, Chaz didn't want to come right out with the word blackmail. Rolvag